All right, so we have finally made it to the New Testament. So you can turn between Malachi and Matthew. Whatever book you have between there. Actually, as far as turning, probably we're not going to be looking at a whole lot of verses, but we will be looking at a couple in Nehemiah chapter 9. So if you want to find Nehemiah chapter 9. Okay, so in our last study, we were looking at the book of Malachi. So just to do a review of that, what is in the book of Malachi? All right, yeah, pretty good. So Malachi, our summary there was Malachi shows the return from Babylon is not the restoration of promise, and that the sins of Israel show they are not ready for the coming of the Messiah and his kingdom. So what were some of the ways that Malachi helps modern readers? Right, yeah, as Malachi was speaking to the people of Israel at that time and rehearsing the prior revelation that God had given, showing how that God has been faithful and teaching them to trust. Okay, so we're going to go back for just a minute just to refresh ourselves a little bit on this whole study. At the very beginning of the study, we asked the question, what is biblical theology? Because ultimately this is a biblical theology study, and that really, I guess, sort of sets the tone for how we are progressing through the Bible. So this is the definition that we use. Biblical theology is a way of reading the Bible as one whole unified book revealing the redemptive purpose of God through history. All right, so that's biblical theology. So we're looking at the Bible as being one whole book, ultimately about one story, and all of the individual parts of it are connected to that story and are in some way contributing to the progress of the revelation to get us to the ultimate fulfillment. So in the obviously in biblical theology, we are primarily focusing on Jesus Christ, the person of Christ in the Old and the New Testament. So in the Old Testament, we were focusing on the promise of his coming, the incarnation. In the New Testament, we will be focusing on the incarnation, his actual coming to his return. So in biblical theology, as we've been going through this study, the flow of history in the Bible is recognized as a flow of revelation concerning Christ. As you go, as you progress, you're learning more about who this promised seed is, who this son of David is, and other circumstances of his life and death and what have you. Reading the smaller parts of the Bible in terms of where it is in the timeline of his coming and what it contributes to the progress of revelation. So as we have worked book by book through the Old Testament each week looking at these, we're not trying to say, you know, every single thing that's in a book. We're trying to see where this book is in the progress of revelation, where is it at historically and chronologically in the revelation of Scripture, and especially what does it contribute? And you'll notice that whenever we get to our interpretation sections, we always ask or made the statement of how the book contributed to the expectation of the Messiah and his kingdom. So we've been focusing on that through this study. Okay, so when we talked about the Old Testament as a whole, this was our summary of the Old Testament. The Old Testament is about the promise of the coming Messiah, who will be God's anointed servant to take away the sins of his people and establish his everlasting kingdom of peace where he will dwell with his people. So that was our summary for the whole entire Old Testament. Okay, so now we have come to the New Testament. So what are some things that are in the New Testament? Well, obviously, the coming of Jesus, his birth, his life, death, burial, resurrection, and ascension. That obviously takes up a large part of the New Testament. The New Testament shows us the establishment of New Testament church to perpetuate the witness of Christ in this age. The renewed promise of the coming of the Messiah, which now we understand as the second coming, or the return, to to gather and to save and to restore Israel, which would be the 12 tribes, the northern and southern kingdom, to the land of promise, promised in the Abrahamic covenant, in a kingdom with Jesus Christ as king, promised in the Davidic covenant. And it gives us a picture of new heavens, new earth, new Jerusalem, and the eternal ages. All right, so just in a nutshell, that's what we're looking at in the New Testament. So here is a summary. This is what we've got on the board that everybody got wrist cramp earlier trying to write down all that. This is the summary of the New Testament now. The New Testament is about the coming of the Messiah, who is God's anointed servant, to take away the sins of his people by his sacrificial death on the cross, burial, resurrection, exaltation to heaven, and the promise of his return to establish his kingdom of peace on earth, where he will dwell with his people. All right, so this is the Old and the New Testament together. The Old Testament is the promise of his coming and his kingdom. The New Testament gives us his first coming and the promise of his second coming, which will actually be the coming of the kingdom and establishment of that kingdom. Okay. So we got a lot that we're trying to cover here, so I'm going to be probably moving a little more quickly than I normally do. So let's go on to observations about the New Testament as a whole. The New Testament has how many books? 27. Yeah, we can divide the books of the New Testament into four main categories. The Gospels, be four books. History, which is one book. The Epistles, which is 21 books. And Prophecy, which is one book. All right, so we can use those four categories to divide up the books of the New Testament. The Old Testament begins with creation in Genesis. And that is about 4004 B.C. Now, you'll sometimes will see some different dates for that creation. And the study of chronology is very complicated. It's interesting, but it is very complicated. And I've seen a range of 4400 B.C. to almost 3600 or something like that. So I've seen a range of several hundred years of dating of the actual creation. But nevertheless, just 4004, that was established by Usher, and in his, which he had a very important work on chronology. But anyway, so the Old Testament begins with creation in Genesis, so 4004 B.C. And it ends with Nehemiah and Malachi. And that was around 430 to 420 B.C. So, the Old Testament covers about 3,584 years. So you're looking at about 3,500 years that Genesis to Malachi covers. The New Testament begins with the birth of Jesus. And I've seen this dated anywhere from about 6 B.C. to 4 B.C., so it's somewhere in that time. And it ends with John on the Isle of Patmos, and that's at about 95 A.D. So the New Testament covers only about 100 years. It mainly just covers that first century A.D. Old Testament, 3,500 years. New Testament, 100 years. So a much smaller span of time that is covered there, and really a lot more detail in that time. So let's just sort of walk through the New Testament by these categories that we have here. So the Gospels are first, Matthew to John. The Gospels themselves are historical narrative about the birth, life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. They are written by four different authors, and were written over a span of time from about the middle of the first century till closer to the end, sometime in the 80s when the Gospel of John was written. So about 40 years or so span of time, 30 years span of time. The historical book is the book of Acts. And Acts is a historical narrative beginning with the ascension of Jesus Christ and the expectation of his return to earth, and giving us the account of the spreading of the gospel through his apostles and churches. Now, Acts was written by who?
Luke.
Right. And it covers about 30 years of time from the resurrection of Jesus until about in the early 60s AD. Paul's imprisoned in Rome, and not too long before he was killed. Next are the church epistles, the epistles. And the epistles has 21 books. That's that can be further broken down into different categories. First of those would be the church epistles. So the church epistles, these are the letters that are written to specific congregations, and they give instructions, they give answers to questions sometimes that they had asked, for instance, of Paul, or they address different situations within those churches. So those church epistles are all written by Paul, and they date from in the early 50s to the early 60s. So they stretch out over about a decade of time in which those were written. The next category in the epistles would be the pastoral epistles. So church epistles would be, what would it be, Romans to 2 Thessalonians. And your pastoral epistles would be 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. The pastoral epistles were written, two of them to Timothy, one of them to Titus, and they were written to give instructions for setting churches in order and teaching churches their responsibilities primarily. That's what these letters were for. These letters were also written by Paul, and they were written in the early to mid-60s, so very close until the time of his death that these were written. Then we come to the next group of the epistles would be the general epistles. That would start with Philemon, and that would go all the way through Jude. General epistles. General epistles are letters that are written to individuals or to groups or churches in different places, and they address a variety of subjects. The general epistles are written by at least six different authors, and they date from the early 40s, which being the earliest of those letters, which is would be the letter of James, to the early 90s, which would be the epistles that John wrote of the first century. So they go across quite a span of time. So then you come to the last one there, which is the book of prophecy, and that's where the book of Revelation. So Revelation is a book of prophecy, mostly looking forward to fulfillments of prophecies began in the Old Testament, prophecies that will be fulfilled at the end of the age. These were written by the Apostle John in the late 90s of the first century, so just before the close of the first century. Now you can notice, if you think about the order of the Old Testament books, that there's actually some mirroring that goes on there. Old Testament, of course, starts out with the law. New Testament starts out with the Gospels. The Old Testament has books of history. The New Testament has a book of history. The Old Testament has books of poetry or of wisdom. Could be similar in some ways to the letters, and then ends with prophecy. And that's the New Testament roughly follows the same pattern of the Old Testament in that. Now, the books of the New Testament are, as we have them in our Bibles, they're not ordered strictly chronologically. They're actually more along this grouping that we've been talking about. They are generally chronological, though, if you think about it, because you start with the birth of Christ and you end with the book of Revelation and speaking of the return of Christ and what's to follow after that. So they are generally chronological, but not strictly. Okay, so our outline for the New Testament is what we have up here on the board, and that's the four categories. So the Gospels, Matthew to John, four books. The history is Acts, one book. the epistles, Romans to Jude, and that's 21 books. And again, you can further break that down into the three categories, the church epistles, pastoral epistles, and general epistles. And then prophecy, the book of Revelation, that's one book. All right, so we're going to move on to some interpretation here in the New Testament. So what's the New Testament ultimately about? What is it that we're learning in the Old Testament? Now, so again, this is a study of biblical theology. And in terms of biblical theology, which means what? What is biblical theology?
One thing to the whole book.
Yeah, so the Bible is one book. It has many parts, but it's one whole unified book or story. So in terms of biblical theology, when we come to the New Testament, we should expect continuity with the revelation of the Old Testament and progress of that revelation toward the end goal of redemptive history. So in other words, the Old Testament has set us up that way. And so we expect if there's continuity, then that's what we're going to find. All right, now this is where Nehemiah chapter 9 comes in. We have an excellent summary of the Old Testament in Nehemiah chapter 9, verses 6 to 37. We're not going to read all those verses. I'm going to read a couple. But let's just quickly walk through what we have here in Nehemiah chapter 9, verses 6 to 37. It starts in verse 6 with creation. Verses 7 to 8, the choice of Abraham and God's covenant with Abraham. Verses 9 to 12, the exodus from Egypt. Verses 13 to 15, the covenant with Moses and Israel at Sinai. Verses 16 to 21, the rebellion of the people of Israel and their wilderness wandering. Verses 22 to 25, Israel enters the land. Verses 26 to 31, rebellion that extends through the time of the judges all the way through the time of the kings. Verses 32 to 35, we have the captivity or the exile from the land. And in verses 36 and 37, we have the return, but the continuing of exile. So we are going to read these verses here. Now remember what's going on in Nehemiah. This is after the Babylonian captivity, after the decree to return. There's been three different waves of returnees. They've rebuilt the temple. They are rebuilding the wall and all of that sort of thing. They're rebuilding Jerusalem, and they are inhabiting it. But Jerusalem is still under the control of the Persian Empire. So after this is, and this in chapter 9 of Nehemiah, what we have is a covenant renewal type ceremony where all the people are gathered together. They had reading of the books of the law. They have, they're giving here what would be considered a public confession of assembly. And so this, ultimately these verses that I've pointed out are part of the prayer, Nehemiah's prayer of confession on that day. And so he has, as you read through that, you will notice that he continues to refer to God's faithfulness and to God's righteousness, that God was right in what he did, that Israel was rebellious, they were stiff-necked, they deserved the judgment that came to them, God was right to punish them, and God's faithfulness has ultimately meant that they're not destroyed. So here we come down to verses 36 and 37. Behold, we are servants this day, and for the land that thou gavest unto our fathers to eat the fruit thereof and the good thereof, behold, we are servants in it. And it yieldeth much increase unto the kings whom thou hast set up, or whom thou hast set over us because of our sins. Also they have dominion over our bodies and over our cattle at their pleasure, and we are in great distress. All right, now this is them back in Jerusalem, rebuilt temple, with the wall and all of these things, that Jerusalem being rebuilt. And Nehemiah is saying, we're in the land that you promised to our fathers, but we're slaves in this land. We are ruled over by masters. And this good produce of the land that God has promised that they would eat of and would be a bountiful supply to them, he says, it's been eaten by the kings that you have put over us, and we are in distress. All right, so that's the picture of Israel in the land after returning from the exile. So what that means is, this is the way the Old Testament ends. It ends with some of the Jews in the land, in part of the land of Israel, but under the control of the Persian Empire, and essentially being slaves or servants or under tribute to the Persian Empire, and the produce of the land benefiting others more so than them. All right, so that is not at all the picture that is painted by the prophets of when the Jews will be restored to their land. So the Old Testament ends with unfulfilled expectations. The Messiah has not come. The time the Old Testament ends, he has not come. He's not come, and all of these things that were expected of the Messiah, he's not come to make an atonement for the people's sins, like Isaiah prophesied about. He has not come to gather all the scattered remnant of the tribes of Israel that are still at this point scattered all among the nations. He has not come to restore to them the land of promise such that it is their possession, and that they are not being ruled over by the nations of the earth, but they are ruling over the nations of the earth. He has not come to establish the Messianic kingdom. He has not come to defeat all their enemies. He has not come to bring them safety, peace, and prosperity. All these things that are expected of the Messiah, they have not happened by the time the Old Testament ends. So ultimately, the kingdom has not come. The covenants with Abraham and David have not been fulfilled. The promises of the prophets of the future nation of Israel and Judah united together have not been fulfilled. So that's how the Old Testament ends. So for continuity of revelation to occur, we would have to have one of two things. We would either have to have a New Testament where we have complete fulfillment of all the expectations of the Old, or we would have to have a New Testament where we have some fulfillment of the expectations of the Old, plus additional revelation leading to the complete fulfillment of all the expectations of the Old. In other words, in order for there to be continuity between the Old and the New Testament, and to be continuing that same storyline all the way to the end, that's what we would have to have. It would be discontinuity if there were no fulfillment of these expectations, or if there were fulfillment that was changed or was fundamentally different from those expectations. We would have a discontinuity in that case. That would make the New Testament a different story, one that replaces the story of the Old Testament. The Old Testament would be over and done, and now we're starting with something else, as though God had a certain end in mind, but changed his plans about how to get there halfway through. All right, that would be a discontinuity between Old and New Testament. However, if we are convinced that the Bible is a unified whole book, then we would expect to find a continuity where there are some fulfillment of the expectations of the Old and then additional revelation that leads us to the complete fulfillment of the expectations of the Old. That is what we find in the New Testament. It maintains continuity with some fulfillment of those expectations from the Old and that additional revelation leading to the complete fulfillment of all expectations. So how do we know that that's the way it should be? Well, because that is the pattern of continuity that we see within the Old Testament itself. So as we have gone book by book through the Old Testament, we have seen this. Think about, for instance, as you move from the law to the prophets. What do you have in the prophets? Well, in the prophets, you see that a number of things have been fulfilled that were promised back here in the law, but still not all of the promises have been fulfilled. And in the prophets, you find additional revelation given that moves that progress, makes progress toward that end, and gives us more information about the fulfillment of those expectations. So in other words, the prophets don't change what was expected and revealed through the books of Moses. The prophets don't change that. They don't alter it. They don't turn it into something else. They see it for what it is, and then they add revelation to that is bringing that to the end. So in other words, that's how we see that the Old Testament is internally consistent with itself. So that's what we expect out of the whole. And that's what we find looking at the New Testament and the Old Testament. All right. There is a gap of a little over 400 years between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. So just to rehearse this real quickly, the northern kingdom of Israel was carried away captive by the Assyrian Empire. That was in 722 BC. The Assyrian Empire was conquered by the Babylonians from about 612 BC to 605 BC. The southern kingdom of Judah was carried away, and Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC. The Persian Empire conquered the Babylonian Empire in 539 BC, and the Persian king Cyrus in 538 BC issued the decree allowing the Jews to return to Jerusalem. Zerubbabel led the first return in 538 BC, built an altar, offered sacrifices. He began work on rebuilding the temple, and the temple would ultimately go on to be completed in 516 BC. Ezra led the second return in 458 BC. He brought all the golden vessels, all those things that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from the temple before they destroyed it. He brought all those things back to the temple. Nehemiah led the third return. This was in 445 BC. Rebuilt the wall of Jerusalem. And the Old Testament ends, again, it's about 430 to 420 BC. The Old Testament ends with some Jews in Judea. Most of the Jews are scattered, dispersed among the nations. And the Jews in Judea are under rule by the Persians. That's how the Old Testament ends. Now, the time between these testaments, this little over 400 years, it follows in particular, in other words, the events that unfolded through this time follow the prophecies of Daniel for the kingdoms, beginning with the Babylonians. You remember the giant statue with the head of gold. And Daniel revealed, Nebuchadnezzar, you are that head of gold. But the Babylonian Empire was the head of gold of this statue. So that's particularly in Daniel chapters 2, 7, 8, and 11. So the events that unfold during this time follow this prophecy that Daniel foresaw of this time. So the Babylonians were this head of gold of this great kingdoms of the earth. And then they were conquered. They were conquered by the Persians. The Persians reigned for about 200 years. So from about 539 BC to about 335 BC. So through the end of the Old Testament and extending about 100 years after the end of the Old Testament, the Persian Empire was in power. What empire was it that conquered the Persians? Not yet. It was Greece. Yeah, not yet. All getting close. It was actually the Macedonian Empire of the Greeks. And they were led by a very famous general, Alexander the Great. Yeah, so we're talking now in the early part of that 4th century, in the early part of the 300s. The Greeks were led by Alexander the Great, who was a student of what philosopher? Does anybody remember? Anybody know? Aristotle. So that was the time of Aristotle. Aristotle was tutored by Plato. Anyway, that's about where we are in world history, time of Plato and Aristotle. Alexander the Great.
Is there anything in the Bible about
that time? Yes. That's what we're getting ready to talk about. Yeah. The Macedonian Empire was led by Alexander the Great. And they defeated the Persians. This was about 334 BC. And this actually corresponds to Daniel's vision in Daniel chapter 8, verses 5 to 7, and verses 20 to 21. And he actually mentions the Persians and the Greeks. Alexander the Great is not named in Daniel's prophecy, but he is in that prophecy. He does name the Persians and the Greeks. And in chapter 11, verse 3. All right, so that's 334 BC. So then Judea came under the control of the Greeks. Instead of the Persian Empire, now they're controlled by the Macedonian Empire. Now, the Macedonian Empire did give the Jews a lot of liberty as far as following their own customs and following their laws and their religious observances and such. Alexander the Great, what was his great vision for the world? He basically wanted to make the Greek culture to be the world culture. That was his ambitious goal. And sounds like he might have accomplished it if he hadn't have died. But that was his goal. That's what he was aiming to do. So now we find it interesting during that time is when the Jews in Israel especially, they come under a different sort of problem, because now they're facing the problem of Hellenization. Whereas before they're facing the problem of the idolatries of the Canaanite nations, now they're facing this problem of the Hellenization, which does involve some idolatry, but is a much larger philosophy and much more attractive, very sophisticated. Anyway, so the Macedonian Empire stretched at Alexander's peak from Greece all the way to what country? India. Yeah, all the way to India, from Greece to India. So he covers all of that Middle Eastern area. Went down into the northeastern part of Africa, in parts of Egypt. And basically, when he died, his plans were to conquer that Arabian Peninsula. He was going to go into Arabia at that point. He died in 323 BC. Was somewhere around about 33 years old. It's one of history's great mysteries as to how he died. A lot of different theories and such about that. After his death, so this Macedonian Empire was just huge. I mean, all the way from Greece to India. You look at that on a map, it's an enormous area. So this Macedonian Empire just became huge, but it was split apart after his death. The Macedonian kingdom actually divided. There were various civil wars. They divided into two main parts. This was prophesied in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 22 and chapter 11 and verse 4. They divided into a northern kingdom that was ruled by the Seleucids in Syria and a southern kingdom that was ruled by the Ptolemies in Egypt. So during this time, basically you have a northern Seleucid Empire, part of the Macedonian Empire, and you have a southern Ptolemaic Empire as part of the Macedonian Empire, and Israel was kind of caught in the middle. And there was just a constant conflict and contention and fighting for control over Israel. In fact, you could read about the times that it was so dangerous to live in Israel that there were many Jews at the time that just left Israel, and they went down into Egypt, down into Alexandria, because it just was so dangerous being in Israel at this time. It was such a war-torn area, constant fighting over Israel. Now, the Ptolemies of the southern kingdom, of Egypt, had control over Israel from about 301 B.C. to 198 B.C. Now, during this time period is when the Greek translation of the Old Testament, known as the Septuagint, that began in Alexandria, Egypt in 277 B.C. And then you had Antiochus III of the Seleucids. He defeated Ptolemy Epiphanes, and he gained control of Israel. This was in 198 B.C. And so they had control of Israel for 198 to 143 B.C. And really, really, Daniel chapter 11, a lot of these things that unfolded is prophesied there in Daniel chapter number 11. And that was when the famous revolt happened in Israel. What revolt was that? Yeah, the Maccabean revolt. So the Maccabean revolt was led by Judas Maccabeus, and it lasted from about 166 B.C. to about 142 B.C. And at the end of that time, the Jews in Judea, they gained a brief independence from the Seleucids during that time after the Maccabean revolt. And they coincidentally gained that independence by sort of indirect help because of the rising of the Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire is rising and gaining strength and is really threatening the Macedonian Empire at this point. Finally, the Roman Empire would overtake the Macedonian Empire, and again, still fulfilling the prophecies of Daniel. And by 63 BC, Israel would be fully under control of the Roman Empire. So Daniel chapter 2, verse 40, and chapter 7, verse 7. So during this time that Rome was ruling over Israel, there was constant unrest and rebellions and revolts and trying to put those things down. And that led to the Romans establishing Herod the Great as a king over Judea. And he ruled from 37 B.C. until 4 B.C. Herod the Great died in 4 B.C. So Herod the Great was actually the king of the Jews when Jesus was born, when the New Testament opens. Okay, so the New Testament begins with the renewal of prophecy. There was no prophecy given during this four centuries between Malachi and Matthew. And actually the first prophecy given is that's recorded in the first chapter of Luke. But there was no prophecy, so sometimes that's referred to as the 400 silent years. There's a decent little book, I think, actually has that title, and it's a quick read about the history of that time if you're interested in studying that more. But the New Testament begins with the renewal of prophecy and with the birth of the forerunner of the Messiah, which is John the Baptist, who was prophesied that he would come before and prepare the way of the Lord, and then with the birth of the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth. So now, in the New Testament, the Messiah has come. And we have all the heavenly host praising him. We have all the celebration in the early part of the gospel accounts to talk about his birth. But rather than establishing the kingdom, Jesus goes on to be crucified by the Romans outside of Jerusalem. And the gospels end with his resurrection. Rather than establishing the kingdom after his resurrection, he ascends to heaven to sit at the right hand of the Father. Now, Acts continues the revelation from the Gospels and gives an explanation of this new age, of why that Jesus had not set up a kingdom, all of these things, his ascension to heaven, what that means and how that fulfills expectation of the Old Testament. And then we find that Israel rejected Jesus. They rejected him when he came. They rejected him again after his resurrection as his witnesses presented him again to Israel. We've been studying a lot of that as we've been going through the book of Acts. Paul explains about this particular age, and this is the age in the Old Testament known as the last days. And Paul explains about this age in Romans 9 to 11. He explains that the Jews have been left in exile. Remember how Nehemiah, we saw that verse 36 to 37, We are in this land, but we are servants here. In other words, their exile is not totally ended. They, some of them were physically in the land in and around Jerusalem, but they were still yet in servitude. So the Jews have been left in exile, and Gentiles are being gathered in. And this is an expectation from the Old Testament as well, and it will continue throughout this age. God's witness to the earth in this age is not a nation, like the nation of Israel. God's witness to the earth in this age is His churches, made up of peoples of all nations, who are tasked with preaching the gospel and observing His ordinances until He returns. Paul also explains in Romans 9-11 that though Israel remains in exile, there is still yet a future salvation and restoration for the nation of Israel. The New Testament ends with a prophecy concerning the end of this age and the coming judgment that culminates in the day of the Lord. It shows us how Israel will be saved and restored to their land. Jesus Christ will rule from the throne of David. Israel will be a blessing to the nations of the earth, and His kingdom will give way to the final judgment, the great white throne judgment, and the coming of the new heavens and a new earth that will continue throughout the eternal ages. All right, so some applications of the New Testament. How that the New Testament helps us and speaks to us today. And let's see, I think I have four of these. So number one, reading and understanding the New Testament helps us understand the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for sins and how salvation is promised alike to all through faith in His name apart from the works of the law. Number two, understanding the New Testament helps us see how God is faithful to fulfill His promise and gives us hope that He will ultimately fulfill every promise He has made. Number three, understanding the New Testament helps us to see the connection between the Testaments so that they are two parts of a whole. And number four, understanding the New Testament does help us understand how we are to live our lives in this age while we wait for the Son of God.